because pathogens don't need passports.
That's absolutely right.
Correct, correct. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to People, Parasites, and Plagues, a podcast aimed at delivering information about the fascinating pathogens among us from the scientists who study them. I am Kim Klonowski.
And I'm David Peterson, your host for today's episode. The liver is an amazing multifunctional organ playing roles in digestion, producing serum albumin, processing glucose, and many other functions. However, the liver itself can be targeted by pathogens, including the malaria parasite. How does the liver defend itself from such an insult?
Our guest today is Dr. Sam Kurup, assistant professor in the Department of Cellular Biology and a member of the Center for Tropical and Emerging Global Diseases. Dr. Kurup studies immune defenses to protect us from pathogens, focusing on how these processes defend us against the liver stage of malaria. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, Sam, as a malariologist myself, in a way, I'm kind of jealous that I understand you've actually had malaria, because I feel as if it's a requirement to be considered a real malariologist. Is that true?
Well, I think if I had a choice, I would have chosen not to. But, I mean, it's also hard to know in a lot of cases, because malaria can be asymptomatic and you fall sick. And in some cases, they know it's malaria because they had a harsher version of the disease and they get tested and all. In a lot of cases, you may not even know. If you're a child, it's less likely that you wouldn't know. But as an adult, sometimes it may be treated as something and it may subside, although it's hard to, you know, in a lot of cases, my point is it's hard to determine if you really did not have malaria before. Yeah.
Still, I think it's another notch in your belt. So you,
I don't know if it's a point of pride, but
I feel like it gives you a little bit of an leg up compared to other
bragging rights. Yeah,
bragging rights, maybe. Been there, done that kind of thing. But in all seriousness, malaria is a very devastating disease. So maybe you can give us some information on how much malaria impacts the rest of the world, because I don't think that we think about that as much, or maybe as much as we should here in the United States.
Right. So if you look at the sheer numbers, it's huge, right? At least pre-COVID, it was considered a huge number, like millions of people infected. But what really boggles my mind is over half of the population live in pretty much malaria endemic areas. So 1 in 2 humans alive today are at risk of contracting malaria, which is insane, like statistically. So that makes it a very, very important disease. And if I remember it right, malaria is recorded in, like, for example, Guinness Book of World Records as to having killed the most number of humans since the Stone Age. And malaria drugs are the most dispensed drugs in the world. So that just tells you the impact of this disease. Even if you forget the total number of people being infected or the 200 plus thousand people who die, like mostly kids, even if beyond that, it's just the sheer scale of the infection.
And not just the infection itself, but things like economies.
Oh, absolutely. The number of work hours lost, the amount of investment that is in place in relatively poorer countries that is sort of inevitable to treat this disease. All that stuff, you combine all that stuff, it's a huge economic and social impact on our lives.
Yeah, I think that's underappreciated, the economic impact of infectious diseases, malaria chief among them, I believe.
Right.
You sometimes hear things about how much the COVID pandemic cost us just in the U.S. alone, but it kind of gets lost in all the other numbers, and it's not huge compared to our economy, but in developing countries, that it's a huge effect on their economy.
Absolutely. And in this interconnected world where commerce is very much interconnected and our economies depend on a lot of other countries' economies, our military presence in a lot of these places. So malaria has a lot of indirect impact on our economy, on our own economy, not just direct cost of treatment or prevention. It's also how much it impacts in other ways.
So Sam, in previous episodes, we've talked to people who study malaria-transmitting mosquitoes. There's a lot of research overall on malaria for the blood stage. You study the parasite in one of its earliest stages in the human host because it comes in delivered by a mosquito. The sporozoite travels to the liver, goes through a process, eventually invades a liver cell there, a hepatocyte. What's the importance of studying the liver stage?
So there is no clinical malaria without an invasion of the hepatocyte. So by that, what I mean is the parasite, once it's delivered by the mosquitoes, like you mentioned, it has to go infect the hepatocytes. And it undergoes development there, in case of humans, about 7 days. And after that, only can these parasites invade the blood stage. And this blood stage of infection of Plasmodium is entirely responsible for all of the clinical or the clinical infection, as we know in the case of malaria. The liver stage is, although it's pretty silent, it is a prerequisite for any clinical disease. So this makes the liver stage a pretty attractive target for generating vaccines, because if you stop the parasite from developing beyond the liver, then you automatically don't have clinical infection. Also, the mosquitoes which transmit the disease do so after collecting the parasites from the blood. So if you stop the parasite within the liver, then you also don't have any transmission. So that is seen as a pathway to prevention or even eradication of the disease.
Yeah, you hear of the liver as discussed as a bottleneck.
Right, right. It is because of the very fact that if you stem the infection in the liver, then you prevent malaria practically. So it is a bottleneck from that angle. But also the flip side is liver is a huge organ and very, very few hepatocytes need to be infected to actually have the parasite progress to blood stage. Because even though a single parasite might invade a hepatocyte, what comes out is some 10 to 30,000 parasites from each liver cell, and which can go on to create, produce a full-on infection. So even 90% efficiency may not be enough. If few hepatocytes are permissive, that's good enough for the parasite to create a full-blown infection. Because once it goes to the blood stage, then it's there, and it can cause clinical infection and death and whatnot. So from one angle, yes, the liver is a bottleneck for the parasite, but from a preventative side, it's also equally challenging because you need 100% efficiency to stop the infection. That is a problem. And it's also looking for the infected hepatocytes. The few infected hepatocytes in the whole liver has been compared to looking for a needle in a haystack, because it's those very few cells that you have to track down. You're depending on your immune system to track down those cells that are infected.
So Sam, when we think about immunity, the first thing that most will come to mind for most people are antibodies or T cells that might be able to kill an infected cell. But now we're talking about a non-immune cell like a hepatocyte. So does this cell have any defenses of its own?
Right. So some of the work that we do in our lab, there are some other research outside of our lab also that has been done in the past that point towards this. But what we see is that hepatocytes by themselves have internal mechanisms to combat the parasite that is growing within it. So these are called cell intrinsic immune responses, and these have been described in other cells too. So what it essentially means is almost all cells are expected to have some way of defending against intracellular pathogens. So mostly these defenses use existing biochemical pathways like autophagy pathways and things like that, which the cells have evolved to take care of business within, like recycling organelles that are not needed anymore or damaged pieces, like proteasome pathways with which it can destroy proteins which it doesn't need anymore, and that recycling mechanisms that exist in a cell. So these defense pathways are modifications, so to speak, of these existing pathways, or usurp these existing pathways to actually try and defend the cell against intracellular pathogens. And these defenses exist against viruses, bacteria, and we are learning that these defenses also exist against Plasmodium, which can invade cells. This is particularly important because when we look within the liver, 90% of the infected hepatocytes appear to not let the parasite complete its cycle. Only 10% seem to be permissive. So
that's really pretty good, 90%.
In a normal organism, for a normal organism, I would say yes, but these 10%, that's responsible for all these deaths, if you think about it. So this organism is so good, and it has evolved so well with humans that it's somehow beating the system. Just that 10% is causing all this havoc. But that also gives us the opportunity, or this can be seen as an opportunity for an optimist that, hey, if we can get that 90 to like 99 or 100, maybe there is hope, right?
Now, this is the cells, and would this be called innate immunity for the cell? Or
people have conventionally called it innate immunity. If it were me, I would argue for it to be considered a third arm of immune response in addition to adaptive and innate immune response. This should be called a cell intrinsic immune response, which should exist as a separate branch, because it does not involve immune cells. This does not involve any other professional immune cell, and this is something that every cell should have a capacity to carry out and do. Think of it as like a homeowner defending against a home invasion without calling the cops. Like, no external agency is involved here. It's just me defending my house. And I have a small mechanism with which I can do it. And that's what these cell intrinsic immune responses are.
Okay, interesting. And is there any kind of adaptive immunity to the liver stage? Because people that grow up in endemic areas, they can be, depending upon how fierce the mosquitoes are biting and transmitting malaria, they could get bitten by an infected mosquito multiple times in a week. So
100%. So adaptive immune responses are an important part of defending against liver stage infection. And that is the entire premise of vaccination against malaria, because you can actually generate CD8 T cell responses which are specific to Plasmodium in the liver, and those can target and eliminate the infected hepatocytes. So that is what we are banking on to clear the other 10% of cells following vaccination and following maybe repeated infections.
Right. So I want to kind of take this discussion a little bit higher, kind of away from your specific area. What you study is trained immunity, which is very basic immunology. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what you think is the value in studying basic immunology. Because when we hear about people talking about malaria, it's mostly, you know, at the top of the pyramid, so to say, right? Those are the people who are trying to get the vaccine out into people, right? And bypassing some of the basic studies. So
right. So if you look at the history of, let's say, vaccine development, and I assume that's what you're alluding to, right? So if you look at the history of malaria vaccine development, we made the first breakthrough in the 1960s, where it was Ruth Nissen-Zweig's group, where she actually took sporozoites, which is the form of the parasite found in mosquitoes, which is the transmissible form, right? So she irradiated those sporozoites either within the mosquitoes or just collecting the sporozoites and irradiating it later, and inoculated them into mice, and found that those sporozoites, because they are irradiated, do not complete its development of the liver, but would generate sufficient immune response to actually offer protection. So this was the first sort of successful vaccination. After all these years, we are still at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That has been the best protection we ever got in humans or mice. We haven't moved an inch further. Why? And I think that's because we understand very little about the immune responses against malaria in the liver. Was Ruth Nissen-Zweig's discovery dumb luck? Absolutely not. There was rhyme and reason to using that. And at that time, we barely knew the existence of T-cells because mm-hmm. it was discovered in the 60s. But later on, we figured that T-cells are the ones that are responsible for protection against those vaccines. But we don't. The lack of understanding of how these mechanisms operate in the liver and what are the best ways to generate strong immune responses, how we can improve it, what are the other players in the process. The lack of understanding of all these things have not allowed us to come with newer, better ways of vaccinating against liver, stage malaria, for example. Okay, so I think we need to know the rules of the game before we can actually beat the system. Because at this point, we are playing a game without knowing the rules.
Right. So it's kind of like you have the kids that open the game and start playing without actually getting out the book and looking at how you're supposed to play.
Right. And especially in the case of malaria, what most people have done is we have just tried to see if what has worked in other organisms would work in malaria. And 60 years of research, so to speak, has taught us that, nope, it doesn't. So we need to know what's going on in malaria to actually develop a system that works in malaria.
Right. And those kids that play a game without reading the rules, you know, they just find it more exciting, right? They're just going to go in and they're just going to try all of these different things, right, to see if
and
it works.
Hope it sticks.
And hope it sticks.
Especially if they're funded to play like that.
Well, so that's my next question. So, you know, the sexy thing, the hot thing is usually what gets all the money, right? Something that hasn't been tried before.
See, I don't mean to say that any of the things that we have done over these years have not worked. They have. To some extent.
Or we haven't learned something from them.
Right, right. So let me give you an example. So people have tried newer versions of attenuated parasites. So back in the 60s, we used radiation to attenuate parasites. So people have generated genetically attenuated parasites, and where, if you think about it, that would be a much more safer option. So the newest ones called LARC, where we have like three specific genes knocked out, and we know that 100% of those parasites after infecting the liver would stop its progression from going to the blood and will generate a strong enough immune response that can be protective. Okay, so this was tested in mice and they work. Okay, so we have made progress, but at the end of the day, it's still the same attenuated parasites and the same CD8 T cell responses and things like that. And there are more things that we are yet to know. Another example is when we used irradiated sporozoites to vaccinate, they were immensely successful in the trial that we conducted in humans. When those trials were in Europeans and people from the United States. But when those same vaccines were deployed in Africa, for example, when it was trialed in Mali, there was very little protection. So there are a lot of other factors at play here. And what we think happened there was that the people in Mali who were trialed there had experienced malaria before. Mm-hmm. So malaria vaccine is not like a conventional childhood vaccine. We are going to use it on people who have had malaria before.
Right. Right. It's because when we're giving our vaccines like the MMR, we don't have rampant mumps, measles.
Yes. I mean, or who have had it before. I'm not talking about having to vaccinate people who have an ongoing malaria. Mm-hmm. Even if we even if we vaccinate on people who have been treated with malaria, they've had malaria before. Malaria all produces or has such a huge toll on the human body that the impacts of an infection last a really, really long time. For example, it generates tons of hemozoin, which the system has no way of taking care of. Hemozoin is a byproduct of the parasite that it converts heme in red blood cells, and it accumulates and it just gets eaten up by our scavenger cells, but they cannot remove it from the system. So these scavenger cells die and that's scavenged by other cells, and this takes a toll on our system. So this is just one thing. So there are a lot of long-term impacts of infection, and maybe that's why our vaccines are not effective. So there are a lot of nuances to this. It's not like or as simple as you can put one protein in and it'll protect against malaria, or make an mRNA against one protein and that's going to protect, like we found in COVID or with COVID vaccines, right? So this is a much bigger beast with a 5,000 gene repertoire that it competes with humans, right? And we don't have a lot more than 5,000 genes. So it's a very, very complex organism that it has its own life cycle and a lifestyle within our bodies. So it's not a simple thing.
And it's a lifestyle that has been successful for tens of thousands of years.
100%, right? And it has evolved with us and it has molded its lifestyle according to ours.
So since I'm sitting with two people who study malaria, can you remind our audience what's the first recording of malaria in history?
There's Chinese writings that refer to it that I think go back 3,000 years, Sam?
Probably. And it's hard to say, right? Because from back in the day, we can deduce that, maybe they were talking about malaria.
Right. Yeah. Just from symptom descriptions and writings.
Right.
But a lot of things cause fever.
Exactly.
So.
Right. Right. Yes. But in the modern medicine, the discoveries were made in India by like British physicians who were there at that time when India was colonized.
So this last year we had, I think outbreak is too strong a word, but we had a few malaria cases in the U.S. in Florida.
Right.
And our listeners may not be aware, but every year, I think somewhere around 1,000 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with malaria, but almost all of those got it overseas or somewhere else. It could be businessmen, tourists, military folks returning. But these cases were special because malaria was contracted by people who had not been outside the country.
Right. So that is different, right? I mean, which means that there is natural transmission of malaria. So that for that to happen, you would need to have mosquitoes harboring the malaria parasites and capable of transmitting between people. And that is a new frontier, right? Because that means anybody is going to be at risk of contracting malaria in mainland U.S., right? So it's not an island, it's our mainland. And as far as those mosquitoes can travel, they can transmit malaria. And we had malaria in different parts of U.S., and I was reading some time ago about how malaria was rampant in the Midwest. Missouri State Fair was at one point, a big foci of malaria transmission in the U.S. It was pre-DDT era. And then DDT came along, and with better hygienic practices and things like that, we stamped it out. But with global climate changes and global warming and whatnot, with increasing access of vectors to places where they were not found before, it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time.
Right, because we just have to have an infected person here. And as soon as that insect can pick it up, then and we're done.
And this is not something that's unique to malaria alone, right? I mean, we are seeing other infectious diseases creeping up, other vector transmitted diseases like Chagas disease. We have found like bugs carrying those parasites also in southern states and closer to our southern borders. So we just need to be more vigilant and go forward with the understanding that these are not some foreign diseases which won't be at our shores. It very much is there. And we also should try to not be reactionary, maybe as a society, and then think more about prevention and how we can do things more preemptively.
Because pathogens don't need passports.
That's absolutely right.
Correct. So speaking about vaccines, there is a malaria vaccine.
Depends on who you ask. There are vaccines.
There's one that's done okay. I mean, maybe not.
Right. I mean, 30% protection is okay. But if you look at the scale of malaria, 30% protection is pretty darn good.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
So that was my question to you. So some people seem to be satisfied with that.
Right.
That's a big improvement. And other people are not so satisfied.
Right. I mean, obviously, right? And we are not going to have a perfect vaccine. I mean, from an immunology angle, our COVID vaccine was superb. It was fantastic. Amazing. But yeah, but if you ask a lot of people, they'd be like, that's the worst thing in the world, right? I mean, it had its shortcomings. But even beyond all that, if you look at the sheer numbers, 30% protection is not considered an ideal vaccine.
Right.
But if it can prevent a lot of death in malaria endemic areas, then and that's probably part of the reason why it was approved by World Health Organization. And they have a second, so that was the RTS's vaccine.
Which is Mosquirix, right?
Right, Mosquirix, that's right.
That's the worst vaccine name ever.
It is the worst vaccine name, but I always try to get that out there because I think some people listening might not know the other name.
So there is a newer one, R21 vaccine, that has been approved in some other countries. But again, if you are a traveler where you have a risk of getting malaria, but so these are targeted at specific populations. If you're a traveler, maybe that level of protection is good enough. Depends on the risk, basically. And that's what you need to consider multiple factors before taking the vaccine is what I'm trying to say. It's probably not for everyone en masse deployment. Maybe not. It's my personal opinion, but there are multiple factors.
Well, and that's the other thing that maybe we don't talk about enough either. There are certain vaccines that are going to work better for certain populations. So if you have military that's going to be deployed for a small period of time, that might be okay. But for people who are living in these areas, not sufficient.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line, there is plenty of room for improvement.
Always plenty of room for improvement, especially with that 30%. But you did bring up something about travelers that I think we should talk about for a second, because I think there might be some people out there who said, well, I've traveled to a malaria endemic country and I've just taken a bottle of pills with me and that's what they gave me. And that was supposed to prevent malaria. How come we can't use that in these countries?
Right. So a couple of things to consider is malaria often outpaces our ability to develop drugs against it. So drug resistance development is rampant in this particular organism. And this goes back to something that we talked about earlier. It has 5,000 genes at its disposal, and it can mutate and change itself. And so the pill may not be always effective. And if you happen to encounter a strain of the parasite that is resistant to the particular drug that you're taking, then that drug is of no use. So that's one thing to consider. Also, if you have taken those anti-malarials, then you may have experienced how awful that drug is, and it really affects you in multiple ways. So those are also not ideal situations. Again, things are not ideal without a vaccine, but hypothetically, if we had a vaccine that would protect you 100%, then that would be the perfect thing to have. that it's once and done, or a booster once in a while, or before you travel, and then you get pretty good protection. So those are just a few things to consider. But at this point, maybe those preventative drugs are the way to go.
So let's think big here about challenges for developing vaccines and therapeutics for tropical and global diseases overall. What are the biggest challenges that you see in the next decade or two?
So there are two kinds of challenges as far as I can think of. One is, of course, the science, the scientific challenge, that these are mostly neglected diseases that we don't understand about an awful lot, and more work has to be done, and that's slow, and these organisms are complex organisms. That's just the scientific side of it. The other thing is how these are just neglected diseases, and how it's easy for us to think that, oh, these things don't affect us as much, and maybe we should prioritize other diseases and the funding that's allocated to these and things like that, right? I mean, is malaria research a priority to the U.S. taxpayer compared to, say, combating breast cancer? Okay, so these are non-science considerations that have a major role, right? I mean, how many non-profit organizations or non-governmental organizations are willing to fund research into preventing parasitic diseases that affect the poorer parts of the world compared to things that affect us, right? So those are the key things that impact research into parasitic disease and these neglected diseases.
Our guest today is Dr. Sam Kurup from the Department of Cellular Biology and the Center for Tropical and Emerging Global Diseases. Sam, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be with you all.
Links to additional information about Dr. Kurup's research can be found on our Instagram account at PPPPodcastUGA.
Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast, and if you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us via email at ppp@uga.edu. This podcast is brought to you by the Faculty of Infectious Diseases and the Grady College of Journalism at the University of Georgia. It is supported by the University of Georgia through the Office of Research, the UGA Graduate School, and the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to the New Media Institute at Grady for use of their Studio Not Found podcast facilities, and special thanks to our production assistant, Sid Wigand, for research, editing, scheduling, and keeping us on track.
Fini.